Welcome to the Recruiting Rant Podcast. I'm your host, Gerard Martinez, senior analyst for USCFootball.com. Another quiet week for USC football recruiting. As predicted, no verbal commitments last weekend. Although there was some rumors going around that USC would have multiple commitments, maybe up to five verbal commitments on Father's Day, we gave you a heads up in the war room that there would be no verbal commitments this past weekend. The good news for USC football fans is that there's still three or four players that are considering making verbal commitments here in the next few weeks. The real holdup, as we reported in the war room, is the NCAA and the potential ruling that the NCAA may open recruiting back up. There are several players that have been on the verge of making verbal commitments this past week nationally that are now waiting to see what the NCAA will do. That includes prospects like Blairstown, New Jersey, three-star defensive end Aaron Armitage, Mission Hills, Bishop Alemany, four-star athlete Jalen Smith, and Westlake Village, Oaks Christian four-star linebacker Ethan Calvert. Now, speaking to sources on the college football side of the subject, there's not a lot of optimism that the NCAA is going to lift the recruiting dead period before August. Schools are currently trying to get as many players on campus at once for voluntary workouts, while simultaneously going through COVID procedures to try to stave off any outbreaks among the team. Flying in recruits from all over the country and then attempting to interject them into these team activities, which is really what official visits are all about. It's about touring campus. It's about sitting down, talking to the deans and the professors of the programs and the majors that you're interested in studying. It's having meetings with coaches. None of that seems possible while you're trying to have your own team and your own players go through COVID procedures. If those procedures turn out to be effective and we do have a college football season, the next step for the NCAA is to probably put together some type of plan for official visitors and procedures for them to be able to come into a school, quarantine, be tested, and then be able to interact with the football program. You have to have a methodology or a system in place where you are protecting the team, that is the players and the coaching staff and anybody that might interact with recruits from a potential outbreak. Once you have the team procedures in place that are working consistently, then you can work on a system to bring people in from the outside and be able to expose them to team activities and to interactions with coaches, players, administrators, etc. The earliest I can see that happening would be September, probably mid-September at the earliest. Again, that's if college football programs can treat the players and staff members who test positive, put them in isolation, bring them back healthy, and then also protect the players and staff members on the football team that have tested negative. If there's not a college football season, there's going to be a little bit of limbo there for a while. I think there still will be a plan implemented that involves isolation and involves testing before recruits on visits interact with coaches or any players. Maybe perhaps they push back the recruiting process. Maybe signing day won't be in February. Maybe signing day will be in April or May. That certainly becomes a little harder to predict. Okay, enough of the COVID-19 talk. It's depressing. Let's jump into some questions from the Recruiting Rant podcast thread. Our first question comes from BND1, who says, GM, where does USC stand with Ethan Calvert? Is he one of those ones you mentioned who's waiting to see if he can take summer visits before making a Ethan Calvert, the 6'3", 230-pound four-star linebacker at Oaks Christian High School. Yes, Ethan Calvert is one of those players that we talked about in the opening that does want to take official visits before he makes a decision. Many kids who have talked about making summer decisions wanted originally to take some official visits before making that decision. What's going to happen is the NCAA is probably going to say, listen, we need to figure out what's going to go on with college football first. Once we get that out of the way, once we make that determination whether we can have college football or not, then we'll approach the system that has to be in place for official visits and for the recruiting process to open back up. I think once recruits hear that they're not going to be able to take official visits in the near future, you're going to see a flurry of commitments. There's not going to be this opportunity to see something or experience something by visiting a school that might change their mind. So what they're going to want to do is they're going to want to get their foot in the door. They're going to want to commit somewhere. make sure that they have a ride and they have a place within a football class, and then wait for everything else to play out. And once those dominoes start to fall, you never know what could happen. We could see more than half the class committed before October. Kids may see other kids committing. And like I said, everybody's going to want a spot. There's a lot of uncertainty about football, whether it be at the college level or the high school level. So I could see a lot of kids wanting to commit once they know, okay, summer official visits are off the table. I'm just going to make a verbal commitment, and then I'm going to see what happens. Calvert will more than likely be among those players. Right now, from everything we've heard for the past few months, it's a battle between USC and UCLA. There are some other schools involved as well, but USC and UCLA have been thought to be his co-leaders for a while, and I think in that battle, you feel pretty good about USC. He's good friends with Miller Moss, and that is one of the players that was mentioned when Miller Moss committed that he may have some influence and some impact on. Our next question comes from Mix. Mix says, great work as usual. Thank you for what you do for the site. You're very welcome. Two questions. In your opinion, who had more potential, or should I say, who is the better prospect in high school, Miller Moss or Cody Kessler? Second, how good is Malik Murphy? Has he played enough to get a true sample size? Is his recruitment based on potential? Does he have a chance to be a generational player USC can't miss on? Or is Malachi Nelson the guy they can't miss on? Miller Moss and Cody Kessler don't really compare that well. I would say Miller Moss is definitely a much better pure passer. Cody Kessler put up some crazy numbers in high school, but Miller Moss throws a better ball, and certainly when it comes to arm strength, he gets the ball downfield quicker because he has a better release, and I think he spins the ball better and has better ball placement on his deep ball. As for Malik Murphy, the 6'4", 220-pound sophomore quarterback from Sarah High School, he definitely has a lot more work ahead of him before you're going to start calling him a generational talent. Most of what we've seen from him has been from the camp circuit and has been from the 7-on-7 circuit. In those instances, he's flashed a ton of physical talent. But you want to see more consistency. You want to see him under the lights, be able to lead Sarah to some big games and make some big throws. But physically, he's shown a ton of talent. At the Elite 11 Regional in March, he was one of the top quarterbacks there, regardless of class. So this is a kid that's got some decent mobility, a lot of size, and a big arm, and he throws a pretty ball. So he's definitely a kid to watch out for. He could be one of those kids that becomes a must-get by the time his senior year rolls around. That's even more true of Malachi Nelson, the 6'3", 180-pound quarterback in the 2023 class from Los Alamitos. We've only seen him in a few camp settings, and we saw him regionally at the Elite 11. Again, a lot of talent, but not a whole lot of production at the high school level. Haven't seen him in any big games, haven't seen him make some big clutch throws, and those are the things that are going to define you as a must-get or generational talent coming out of high school. The next question comes from Trojan Man, number 11. When scouting high school offensive linemen, what on-field traits are you looking for besides height, weight, and arm length? Thanks, GM. It really depends on what offensive line position you're talking about. If we're talking about offensive tackles, height and arm length are very important, but so is footwork. Footwork meaning balance. Footwork meaning their coordination between their punch and their ability to kick step. Their ability to get off their spot, punch, and move downfield and run block. And what kind of knee bend do they have? What kind of flexibility do they have when they get to the second level and they have to run block? Because as an offensive tackle, you're probably talking about a player that's at minimum 6'5", 6'6". So they have to be able to gain leverage, and they have to be able to do that in space against a smaller player. With a guard, you don't need the frame and the height, but you still want really good footwork, really good balance, probably a quicker athlete that's a tad more explosive. And because you're going to be blocking 6'1", 6'2", 330-pound defensive linemen, you got to be able to have a lot of leverage. You got to have a lot of power in your lower body. And you got to be able to hit with that initial punch and then be able to move down to engage in the second level of the defense. That explosiveness is really important for offensive guard because you're going to have that initial punch where you're engaging with a very strong defensive tackle, but then you're going to have to disengage and move quickly to the second level of the defense because guards pull and trap far more often than offensive tackles. The same holds true for center prospects, but with the center, I want a prospect with long arms, mainly because he's going to have to snap that ball, and if you have a defense that wants to blitz the A-gaps or maybe stunt the A-gaps, he's got to be able to control that. So he's coming out of a snap, and then he's got to pop up, and he's got to be able to get his hand on a potential blitzer just to slow him up enough. And obviously with centers, you got to have a smart kid. You've got to have a kid who understands how to communicate, understands the calls that he's going to have to make to be able to call out those potential blitzes, those stunts, those shifts. And so he's going to have to absorb the playbook within the playbook on the offensive line. The next question is from David Law, who says, here you go, GM. Number one, of our current commits, who do you think has the biggest upside? Question number two, does UCLA have anyone committed that we want? Question number two first, no, I don't think UCLA has anyone that USC had as a plan A for their recruiting class in 2021. Of USC's current commits, I'd go with either Kalen Bullock, the 6'2", 175-pound athlete out of John Muir High School up in Pasadena, or possibly Zamirian Gordon, the 6'2", 190-pound safety from Warren High School in Downey. Both of those players project as safeties. Bullock I really like because he's played some wide receiver and he has really good ball skills. He's got to put on more weight. He's got to get stronger to be able to contribute at the next level. Whereas Zamirian is a bit more of a finished product physically, but we just haven't seen much of him in person. We haven't seen him at any camps. We haven't really been able to see the flashes that are on his junior film. Our next question comes from Casey Cosgrove. He asks, where do you rank the current USC offensive line commits in 2021 when mixed in with the 2020 class? That's an interesting question. I think combining both classes together, Jonah Monheim out of Moorpark would probably be the number one offensive lineman of the two classes. Then maybe Cortland Ford out of Houston North Park High School would be number two, followed by Mason Murphy out of J. Sarah from the 2021 class would probably be number three. Then it would be Casey Collier, the 6'7", 300-pound offensive tackle from Mont Belvieu, Texas, coming from very good offensive line coaching at the high school level in Texas. And probably after him, Saya Mapakaitolo, the 6'5", 285-pound offensive tackle from Bishop Alemany High School, who's very raw, a lot like Collier, but I love his film. I like both of those players' film because I think both of them have the potential to play offensive tackle. Our next question comes from Priester, who says, saw some film of Kalen Bullock, and he looked pretty good at wide receiver. I know he's been listed as a safety recruit, but could he also go to wide receiver? One that seemed odd to me was offensive tackle Cole at SLO, not being offered by USC, ended up a Bruin. Anything behind the scenes on why USC did not offer him that you know of? Ironically, we actually already talked about Kalen Bullock in the podcast. He's going to be a defensive back at the next level. He has above average ball skills, but overall, safety, free safety specifically, single high is where you want to see him at the college level. As for Thomas Cole, I really don't have any specifics as to what USC didn't like about him. They just didn't see him as a player that was going to fit into their system. The next question comes from P. Polly, who asks, if Aaron Armitage, goes elsewhere, who besides Mobley, Colin Mobley, do we have on our radar at the defensive end position? If you go to the pull-down menus at the top of the page and you see the dot, 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 you'll see the USCfootball.com target list. They'll list every single player that USC is recruiting at each position and specify what position USC is actually recruiting them at. As for Armitage, if he ends up going somewhere else, let's say Florida, because I think that's the other school that he's really considering next to USC, USC then pivots, and I think they go after T.S. Sevilla, the 6'3", 265-pound offensive tackle from Las Vegas, Nevada, Desert Pines High School. He's listed by 24/7 as an offensive tackle, but USC has been recruiting him as a defensive tackle. And I think he and Armitage are actually pretty close in terms of their size and how they play, and I think USC would probably just go on Sevilla. Our next question comes from Green Trojan, who asks, Is Tia Sevilla a take? If so, offensive line or defensive line? Wow, you guys are really coordinated with these questions this week. That's a great follow-up. Well, just talking about Tia Sevilla, USC has been recruiting him as a defensive tackle, and I don't think that's really going to change. I say defensive tackle, strong side defensive end. In USC's defense, your defensive tackles and your defensive ends are not as different as if you were going to play in, let's say, a traditional 4-3 defense where your weak side defensive end and your strong side defensive end physically are a bit different than maybe your 3 technique. You're talking about the difference between a guy being closer to 300 pounds, whereas a defensive end playing on the outside, he's going to be more like maybe 270, 275 as a strong side 5 technique, where he might be, you know, only 245, 250 pounds as a weak side 7 technique in a 4-3. Here in the tight front, those defensive tackles and defensive ends are both going to be hovering around that probably 285, 290 pound range. So I think with Tia Sevilla, he's 265 right now. I think, as I said before with the last question, if Aaron Armitage decides to go to Florida instead of USC, Stanford's also a consideration, but I think Florida's really the other school he's considering, then I think Tia Sevilla is the player that they take. If they get Armitage, then I don't think they take Tia Sevilla as a defensive lineman. The next question comes from SCPA5, who says, the 2022 running back class on the West Coast is the strongest in a while. Which running backs have strong interest, not named Relique Brown? I guess it's just coincidental that these questions and answers are segueing so nicely. We're talking about Tia Sevilla. Well, if you're asking about running backs on the West Coast next year, Desert Pines, Tia Sevilla's high school, has a running back named Javonte Barnes, who's listed at 5'10 or 5'11, I believe, in the database. When I saw him at the Under Armour camp in February, he looked a bit bigger than that. He looked like he was closer to 6 foot, 190 pounds, and is definitely a player that USC's after. Good-looking running back, good-looking combo back, a guy that can carry the ball 20 times a game, and definitely a player on the West Coast that likes USC, and again, I think USC really likes. Another player to watch out for that's pretty high on USC and has a scholarship offer from USC at the running back position is Speedy Luke, Rashawn Luke, the 5'8", 160-pound running back from St. John Bosco. He's one of the fastest players in Southern California right now, regardless of class, and certainly a player that, as an all-purpose back, as a scat back type, really fits what USC is doing offensively really well. The next question comes from Trojan Tito 66, who asks, why do Miami fans think they have high confidence that they can flood Garcia, Jake Garcia, the La Habra 4-star quarterback committed to USC, with tweets and try to get him to flip to the U? To be perfectly upfront, if I didn't have to be on Twitter for this job, I wouldn't have that app on my phone or my computer. It's an echo chamber full of emotional hot takes and narcissistic statements without context. And one of the most cringy things that you'll ever read is a bunch of grown-ass men trying to convince a 17-year-old kid to go to their favorite college. Our next question comes from Cassius, who asked, hey GM, number one, any leans to other schools or commits to other schools that you see ending up a Trojan? I wouldn't necessarily want to predict that USC would flip these players, but I think there's definitely a chance that they could flip Bo Collins, 6'3", 195-pound wide receiver, is committed to Clemson from St. John Bosco. Bram Walden from Segura High School, the 6'4", 270-pound offensive tackle, is committed to Oregon. Clifton Burton Jr., the 5'11", 170-pound cornerback, who's committed to Florida at a St. Francis High School in Baltimore. We talked a little bit about him in the war room. And Rayshon Davis, the 6'1", 220-pound linebacker from Mater Dei High School, is currently committed to LSU. Again, that's not necessarily a prediction that USC is going to flip all those players away from the schools that they're currently committed to, but that's a good group that USC has continued to recruit and has a chance with if they play well this season. The next question comes from Desert Corp, who asks, GM, I can't remember if you speculated on this last week or not, but what do you make of the continued offers at the tight end position? Do you think there's a chance that USC would take an extra tight end if they're unhappy with the third wide receiver prospect at the end? Thanks, Mike, Henderson, Nevada. We did address this in the War Room last week, so check that out for a little more detailed explanation. But in summation, I expect USC to still only sign one tight end in the 2021 class. However, they are going to continue to recruit the best players possible on their board. So while they may have a commitment at a position where they're only going to take one player, or perhaps they have a position where they have two commits and they're only going to take two players, they may continue to recruit players above those that are already committed if they feel those players are ranked higher on their board. So at tight end, USC has a commitment from Lake McCree, the three-star tight end out of Austin, Texas. But the reality of the recruiting process in 2020 is that it doesn't stop when a kid commits to a school. He's going to continue to entertain interest from other schools, probably take official visits, and the schools, in turn, have to do the same thing. So what does USC do? They go out and they offer a scholarship to Thomas Fedone, who is the nation's number one tight end out of Council Bluffs, Iowa. Come National Signing Day, USC will sign one tight end, and that tight end will be the best player available on USC's board. The next question comes from Scoen35, who asks, on what side of the ball would the Trojans want to use Jalen Smith, in parentheses, if they get him? If the answer is defense, who would we go after as the third receiver, parentheses, Christian Dixon, Malcolm Johnson, etc.? USC is recruiting Jalen Smith primarily as a cornerback, specifically, I think, a nickelback that has the potential to really move around within that new defensive scheme that Todd Orlando runs. In terms of that third receiver, I go back to last week's podcast and maybe even the podcast the week before that. We talked a lot about the third receiver and the options that USC is looking at. Christian Dixon's not one of those options. At present date, USC's not recruiting Christian Dixon. Malcolm Johnson, they are. And so out of those two, certainly Malcolm Johnson would be the pick. SCPA5 slides in with another question. With Tony Grimes probably going to UNC, does Georgia go heavy on Nathaniel Wiggins? Speaking about Tony Grimes, the 6-foot, 180-pound, 5-star cornerback, the number one rated cornerback in the nation, according to 24/7 Sports, out of Virginia Beach, Virginia. And Nate Wiggins, the 6-foot, 270-pound, 4-star cornerback out of Westlake High School in Atlanta, Georgia. I think with Wiggins, Georgia's a problem. Clemson is a problem. There are going to be a few different SEC schools that take a swipe at him. So if you're USC, you're not necessarily sitting on your laurels knowing that you were in a good position with him maybe 2 months ago. You're going to have quite a few SEC schools sniffing around Nate Wiggins now that he's a top 247 talent, a top 100 talent, according to 24/7 Sports. Beta Trojan 64 asks, how do the West Coast receivers from the 2022 class compare with the 2021 class? Thanks. I think it compares favorably in terms of depth, but at the very top, if we're talking about the entire Western region, I don't know if there's a wide receiver that's at the level of Amika Mbuka out of Steilacoom, Washington. I think there are very few players in that class that have that combination of power, strength, speed. You're talking about a guy that ran a sub-4.5 at the underclassmen combine in San Antonio, Texas, which is a notoriously slow field. So, yeah, at the very top, I don't know if you have those type of game-breaking wide receivers in the class regionally, but in terms of depth, certainly within California, I think you have more good wide receivers. Our next question comes from Gusiak, who says, hello, GM. Has reporting on prospects slowed down for you as more players commit to schools during this shutdown? How have you kept busy? Recruiting has slowed down the past couple weeks, but as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, there could be floodgates opening up right before a potential college football season. Right now, schools are scrambling to get COVID compliant. They're trying to get their players into isolation and then out of isolation. So that's kind of the focus, I think. I think a lot of colleges, you're going to see the recruiting process begin to slow down as they want to focus on trying to get their football teams on the field and actually getting into voluntary workouts, and then seeing what happens from voluntary workouts and if that can transition into actual fall camp. Nation of Troy asked the next question. He says, thanks, GM. Number one, what recruits do you believe we stand to have a reasonable chance at flipping come signing day? I think we already addressed that question. Number two, how would you assess our recruiting in other West Coast regions such as Hawaii, the Pacific Northwest, Nevada, and Utah? I'm trying to get you to go on a rant. Ha ha. No rant, really. USC's recruiting in Hawaii has almost been non-existent. Now, I don't know if that's because there's just not that much talent in Hawaii for the 2021 class, or because USC's just lost those connections to really be able to recruit the islands really hard. I think it's probably a combination of both, but probably more the former than the latter. Talking to Blair Angulo, who covers Hawaii really well for 24/7 Sports, I don't get the sense that there's a ton of really good prospects that you have to go out there to recruit if you're USC. The Trojans coaching staff has certainly recruited the Pacific Northwest harder in recent years. This recruiting cycle, it really comes down to signing JT Tuimoloau. If they can't sign Tuimoloau out of Sammamish, Washington, five-star defensive end, who I think projects as a defensive tackle that would replace J2Fele, I think Pacific Northwest recruiting for this recruiting cycle is probably going to be looked at as a failure. USC is dabbling in Nevada, which is what every major program tends to do. You have some kids at Bishop Gorman. You have a couple kids at Desert Pines. You're not going to recruit a dozen players out of that area. You're probably in a single cycle only going to recruit maybe three or four at the most. So that's what USC is doing, and they've got a commitment out of Michael Jackson, the three-star, still a three-star wide receiver out of Desert Pines High School. And with Utah, they've only offered two prospects out of the whole state in the 2021 class. So sort of like with Hawaii, I don't know if we can really gauge how well they're recruiting there when they've only got two offers to the whole state. Obviously, the one big get out of Utah is going to be Kingsley Suamataia, four-star offensive tackle out of Orem High School. That's a tough get for USC. He's got the connection to Penei Sewell at Oregon. A lot of people think that he's already penciled in. He's going to Oregon. USC's trying to recruit him. If they don't get him, does that mean that they're not recruiting Utah well? Again, I don't think there's enough prospects there, enough players that USC's actually offered scholarships to gauge whether they can continue to recruit that state successfully in the future. The next question comes from LGT3rd, who asks, Ronnie James Dio versus Ozzie, who you got? And also, how is the recruiting going in Hawaii and the Polynesian region? It seems like we've been sticking to the mainland this year. It's weird that the Ronnie James Dio versus Ozzie Osbourne question came first. And it's, oh, by the way, how are we doing in Hawaii and the Polynesian region? Well, we just literally got done talking about USC recruiting in Hawaii. As far as Ronnie James Dio versus Ozzie goes, if we're talking Black Sabbath, I gotta go Ozzie all day. The next question comes from TDavy93, who asked, with Josh Simmons seemingly no longer a take on the offensive line, well, that's not true. We talked about that in the war room. He is definitely still a take and still being recruited by USC as an offensive lineman. And from what I understand, although his preference is to play defensive line, USC recruiting him as an offensive lineman would not preclude him from going to USC. Biggie BC asked the next question. GM, will we accept a commitment from Christian Dixon? Christian Dixon, the 6'2", 190-pound wide receiver out of Santa Ana Modern Day High School. To answer your question, in short, no. At present date, I do not believe USC is recruiting Christian Dixon. That can always change, but again, right now, I don't see Dixon as an option for USC. Our next question comes from Super Trojan 5, who has a paragraph or two for us. Number one, with the next open quarterback competition likely for the 2022 season, assuming Kedon Slovis leaves after the 2021 season, would USC potentially sign both Miller Moss and Jake Garcia in the 2021 class, impact Malik Murphy possibly committing in 2022? On paper, it certainly could have an impact on Malik Murphy or even A.J. Duffy, the 2022 quarterback out of Rancho Verde High School. With both of those quarterbacks, they're going to look at the depth chart and they're going to look at the fact that Jake Garcia and Miller Moss, even in a redshirt year, will have a year ahead of them in the system. Now, it could be that one of those players actually has to play their freshman year, because as we saw with Caden Slovis, when JT Daniels went down, you're only one snap away from having to step in and play quarterback. So while we could say, you know, they may be kind of sort of lost in the shuffle a little bit if Caden Slovis has this great, spectacular year as a junior, and then Murphy or Duffy could come in and compete against a couple of redshirt freshmen at quarterback. The second question is, I love your recruiting stories on previous recruiting classes. Could you tell us about the running back recruiting in the 2006 recruiting class? USC was recruiting to replace Reggie Bush and Lendell White. USC signed Stephon Johnson, CJ Gable, Allen Bradford, Emmanuel Moody, and Stanley Havili, who converted to a fullback, and Kenny Ashley. Six running backs in one recruiting class. Is it true that they almost were able to get players like Chris Wells, LeSean McCoy, Keelan Williams, CJ Spiller, and Percy Harvin? I believe Michael Goodson and DeMarco Murray were also a part of that 2006 running back class, although USC recruited DeMarco Murray as a cornerback after he was at the Rising Stars camp the summer before as a junior. Of that group, Michael Goodson was probably recruited the hardest as a running back. Percy Harvin was recruited as a receiver. And in terms of game-changing playmaking ability, he was the replacement for Reggie Bush. But in terms of position, he was really looked at more as a slot receiver that in certain situations, maybe you could put him in the offensive backfield and hand him the ball off on an end around or reverse. But for the most part, he was looked at as a wide receiver. Michael Goodson was the running back that early on in the spring they targeted and Pete Carroll fell in love with. He looked at Goodson and he saw a guy that could accelerate through the hole and take it to the house. So they went all in on him early spring into the summer. He comes out on an unofficial visit and everybody feels like, man, we got him locked up. He's coming to USC. He's saying all the right things. After he unofficially visited USC, he was stopping off at Oklahoma before he went back home and was going to make a decision in early July. The Oklahoma visit had some people a little worried around USC. It wasn't Oklahoma that they had to be worried about. Unbeknownst to anybody, he slipped in an unofficial visit to Oklahoma State and committed on the spot. And it shocked everybody. It shocked people at Texas A&M. It shocked people at Oklahoma. And it shocked USC. So he's committed to Oklahoma State. Doesn't really have much to say about why he committed to Oklahoma State. He just liked the people there. He liked the facilities. He's going to Oklahoma State. We fast forward to September-ish, and we start to hear he's going to take some visits. He may not be solid to Oklahoma State after all. Well, and I'm trying to get this right chronologically in my head. I believe he took an official visit to Oklahoma State in like October. And we start getting all this talk the Friday that he's going there to take that official visit. He gets sent home. And all of a sudden we hear Oklahoma State has stripped him of his scholarship. Now, there was a lot of weird stuff that we heard. There was some allegations thrown around by Goodson's camp and thrown around by Oklahoma State as to why he no longer had a scholarship and why he was on the verge of publicly decommitting. It involved a lot of he said, she said, and a lot of allegations that I don't want to regurgitate because they never came to fruition. But let's just say it involved blackmail and it involved something serious enough that it would get a recruit sent home from an official visit the day he actually arrived on campus. So we push forward to the Army All-American game and he's already visited USC officially, loved it, told everybody, yeah, I'm coming. I think he had already gone to Texas A&M as well, and a lot of people in Texas A&M felt confident he was going there. He's supposed to announce at the Army All-American game. They literally have cameras on him, the TV timeout before he's supposed to announce, and then we hear at the last minute he's not announcing. So then we go farther into the year, and Texas A&M ends up hiring his high school football coach as an administrative assistant. End of story. He goes to Texas A&M. Like a year later, I have this conversation with a player parent. I won't say who it was, but it was one of the player parents that had a son who was on the recruiting visit with Michael Goodson. And he's talking to me about Michael Goodson's dad and how he was trying to sell him some property in North Carolina. Michael Goodson Sr., who was Michael Goodson Jr.'s dad, had told this player parent that Michael Goodson was going to USC. He was a lock to go to USC. And then he turns around, he ends up at Texas A&M. So he says half-heartedly, kind of as a joke, you know, I don't know if I could buy property from this guy. I don't know if I trust him. He tells me 1 week that his son is going to USC, and then he turns around and he commits to Texas A&M. Well, we fast forward a few months into the next year, and I get a phone call from a friend of mine in Texas that says, hey, man, did you hear about Michael Goodson Sr.? And I said, no, what about him? Did you hear he got arrested for wire fraud? He's like in prison now for like 20 years. He is in the cling cling. And I called that player parent up and said, yeah, man, I think you made a pretty good decision not to buy that property in North Carolina. But in reality, Michael Goodson was probably the highest rated player at the running back position in that class for USC. CJ Spiller sort of came on later in the year, probably right at the beginning, first four games of his senior season. Pete Carroll watched his film and was totally head over heels. This is the kid that we need to go after. And so they started recruiting CJ Spiller really hard, end up getting him on that official visit, which was the game against Fresno State where Reggie Bush went crazy and basically won the Heisman Trophy. So a few weeks later after that official visit, there's a local report here from a local reporter, everybody knows who I'm talking about, that CJ Spiller had quote-unquote commit to USC. Huge news. So I talked to CJ now and again throughout the recruiting process. I thought I'm going to give him a call. It's like 5:30 our time, so it's 8:30 Florida time. I call up. I get his mom, little small talk with his mom, say, is CJ available? She goes, oh, yeah, sure. So she walks into the other room and gives CJ the phone, and CJ is like half asleep. He is clearly not awake, groggy, and I feel bad now. I go, God, I mean, I'm looking at this, it's like 8:30, he should be up. But for whatever reason, he wasn't up. But I ask him anyways, CJ, there's a report out. Says you commit to USC. I just wanted to confirm that that was true or not. And of course he says, no, that's not true. Yeah, it was an interesting class with a lot of interesting players. And as you said, everybody was thinking this is the class where you got to replace Reggie Bush. And they got a bunch of guys. And obviously none of those players really replaced Reggie Bush. But it was still a very good class with a lot of good players. Our next question comes from Trojan2016, who asks, hi, GM. Would Jake Garcia flipping to Miami help with Malik Murphy? If you were the coaching staff, would you rather have Moss than Murphy as opposed to Moss and Garcia with no Murphy? Thanks. You know, when it comes to something like recruiting two quarterbacks in the class, I think it really comes down to a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. You take talent when you can, you bring it into the program, and you let those two players compete, and it sorts itself out. So to answer your question and to follow up a proverb with an idiom, you cross the Malik Murphy bridge when you get to it. T. Davey 93 comes in with another question. He asks, following up on Trojan 2016 and Super Trojan's posts, could you compare and contrast A.J. Duffy and Malik Murphy as quarterback prospects? And who is more likely to be the quarterback in the 2022 class if one of the current committed quarterbacks goes elsewhere? You know, they're really two different kinds of quarterbacks. I think they're both listed as pro-style quarterbacks in the 24/7 database. But in reality, Malik Murphy is much more of a pocket passer. He's a big kid, 6'4". Again, I think he's listed at 215. He looks more like he's 230. He's good outside the pocket. He throws the ball effortlessly. And once he gets moving and he decides he's going to run downfield, because he's so big, he's really difficult to get down. In contrast, A.J. Duffy is only about 6 foot, 190 pounds, but he runs the ball by design quite often in the Rancho Verde offense. He knows how to get in the open field. He's more agile. He's faster. He's really a different type of quarterback. I will say the one thing about A.J. Duffy that stands out, and I think this is why he got so many early scholarship offers, his deep ball is tremendous. When you see him throw that ball downfield, it's like a raindrop falling out of the sky. And more often than not, he hits his wide receivers in stride on his deep ball. That's something that you can't necessarily teach. That kind of big arm and that kind of deep ball placement is extra and something that takes your offense to the next level if you have those wide receivers that can stretch the field. Boulevard 74 comes in with our next question. He says, when a recruit is described as one who has the measurables but needs to work on his physicality, I wonder how much physicality and toughness are factored into evaluating a player. I assume toughness is inherent, and a player either has it or he doesn't, and it can't be coached into a player. I recall reading your evaluations of certain players needing to step up their physicality, and they didn't pan out despite of having prototypical size. Jacob Daniel, Frank Martin come to mind. What are your thoughts regarding this? Physicality, aggressiveness, and toughness are attributes that I personally look for at positions where contact is constant. At a position where you know you're going to have to overcome, whether it be a block or a tackle, in order to be able to be successful in that particular play. Almost every down. Now, some players are aggressive instinctually, and you see that on film, but other players aren't. And there is a maturity factor that comes in with this. Sometimes if you have a player that's maybe new to football, hasn't played a whole lot of football, they don't realize how physical they can be. They don't realize how tough they may need to be. And a light bulb goes on at some point in their high school football career. Rarely when they get into college does that light bulb go off. Usually it's somewhere between your sophomore and your junior season where you may have a kid that's just a big kid and he's been big all his life, and his parents and his family and everybody around him tell him, dude, you need to chill. You're a big guy. You're going to end up hurting somebody. And then when he gets on the football field, he hasn't played a whole lot, and he realizes that's sort of the point of being out here. On the flip side, if you're looking at a player that's been coached up, he's been playing football for a long time, he's confident out there, he's running around and he's bullying kids, that doesn't necessarily mean that he is more physical than the opposite type of player that just got on the football field, only been playing high school football for a year. He just knows the parameters of what he's capable of more than that other player. So when it comes to physicality, sometimes confidence is the blurry line. Sometimes confidence can take things out of context, and you can see a player and see a lack of physicality when it's really more a lack of confidence. Confidence also makes players play a lot slower because they're hesitant. So you do have to sort of look at things within that context, look for instincts, look for certain instances, maybe even away from the football, where if you see those flashes of physicality, if you see that there are instances where maybe a younger player or a player that just hasn't been coached up that much does have the aggressiveness, then you can sort of say, okay, if he continues to gain confidence, he's going to be able to play more aggressively and he's going to be more physical in the future. BU for USC asks the next question. He asks, could you please compare and contrast 2022 running backs, modern days Relic Brown and St. John Bosco's Rashawn Luke? Thank you. Relic Brown is a tad more compact. His running style is a bit more jitterbug. He's going to try to make moves and use short area quickness to get away from contact. Whereas Rashawn Luke is actually more of a slasher. Neither are big running backs by any stretch of the imagination. They both are around 5'8". Maybe 5'9", but Luke is a little more of a slingshot. He's going to hit the hole, he's going to make one cut, and he's going to get upfield, and he's going to try to outrun the angles. Whereas Relic Brown might hit the hole and make three or four cuts to try to get away from defenders and then be able to try to get into the open field and break angles. So I'd say the difference in their running style is really seen where they get to the line of scrimmage and they get through that first wave of defenders. That's really where they're different running backs. Now, they're also different in terms of their production. Relic Brown's coming from Stockton Edison, where he carried the ball and he was a focal point of the offense even as a sophomore. Whereas Speedy Luke is coming from St. John Bosco, where he had to really sit behind a lot of other good running backs. He hasn't really necessarily had the bulk of carries. He hasn't necessarily had the spotlight to himself yet. So in terms of production, Relique Brown certainly has that on his side, but it's definitely going to be interesting to see how he transitions from Stockton Edison High School to playing in the Trinity League for modern day. It's going to be different. He's going to have a lot of other weapons around him that are going to enable him to make some big plays, but definitely the competition level goes up a few notches at modern day. The next question comes from Urban F. Meyer. Hi, GM. Love these podcasts. Something to look forward to weekly. What is your confidence level currently of USC signing Josh Simmons? Also, is Kingsley Suamataia 100% lock to Oregon? I'd say Suamataia 70% lean to Oregon, Josh Simmons to USC. That's probably 50-55%. The next question comes from Ali for SC. Besides Ernest Gibbs, what Southern California O-liner is USC going hard after in the 2022 class? By Ernest Gibbs, I believe you're talking about Ernest Green, the 6'4", 300-pound offensive tackle from St. John Bosco. USC has offered, I believe, 18 offensive tackles in the 2022 class already. So they're going hard after offensive tackles. They're going hard after offensive linemen. And I think next year's group of offensive linemen is definitely better and deeper, not just locally, but nationally. Other players that USC is recruiting, Kenji Swanson out of Sierra Canyon High School in Chatsworth, California, 6'6", 310 pounds. USC has a good position for Malik Agbo, the Frederick Way Washington offensive tackle, who's 6'6", 295, took an unofficial visit to USC just before the recruiting dead period started and really liked his visit to USC and says a lot of good things about USC, really raved about the campus and the coaching staff. So that's a player that regionally they have a pretty good shot at. They've also offered a ton of players nationally. They went after two offensive tackles from Duncanville High School. We've talked about USC recruiting Duncanville in past podcasts, but Jalen Early and Cameron Williams are both players that they offered Duncanville's offensive line that are sophomores. USC also at the offensive guard position, and they've only offered three offensive guards in the 2022 class. And again, we always talk about it's easier to recruit offensive tackles, move them inside to play offensive guard rather than have offensive guards that you're going to move outside to play offensive tackle. So offensive tackle is always the harder position to recruit. But George Mele, a 6'3", 270-pound guard out of Bingham High School in South Jordan, Utah, is a player that's very high on USC, and USC's been recruiting really hard. Wouldn't be surprised if he commit to USC before the end of his junior year. Our next question comes from Gate Call, who asks, talking on the field ability today, on a scale from 1 to 10, with 10 being Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, where do you put the current USC roster? If they're now on the right track, how many years away from getting to a 10? Example, a 10 being a national championship contender like Clemson, Ohio State, or Alabama. 9, playoff threats like Georgia and Oklahoma. 8, conference championship threats like Washington, Penn State, in Wisconsin. I'd like to give USC a 9 in terms of talent on their roster, but the reality of this situation is that you don't return your left tackle or your right tackle. You don't return any players with any experience at that position to be able to step in, and you didn't sign any high-rated 4-stars or 5-star offensive tackles that could be the exception of the rule and be able to start from day one at either of those positions. You combine that with the fact that USC is coming off a season where they had to play 3 quarterbacks because of injuries. That's not a team that I feel confident in saying is playoff caliber. And you combine that with the fact that USC still has a lot to prove running the football, specifically running the football on 3rd and short. Can they keep their top running backs, their running backs with experience, healthy during the season? None of this takes into consideration the scheme, the weekly preparation that the team will have in practices, and game time management. So as we sit today, I say this team is more at a 7.5 than they are a 9. The good news is, I don't think they're that far away from being a 9. Maybe a couple years, 2-3 at the max, I think they could be at that level. But there's definitely some holes they have to fill in terms of the depth chart, And there's definitely some things that they have to improve from a coaching standpoint, specifically from a week-to-week preparation standpoint. The next question comes from Alonzo, who asked, your prediction on SC, how many wins this season? And also, best Metallica album. I tell you what, if they cancel the season, they're going to win every game. If not, 8, maybe 9 wins. As for Metallica, most people say that Master of Puppets is their favorite album. My favorite album is Injustice for All. I loved Blackened. I loved One. I loved Dyer's Eve. Frayed Ends of Sanity. I feel like the guitar tone of that album was the best and was one of the reasons why they really didn't need bass on the album. The fact is that when you have James Hetfield playing through a Mesa Boogie Mark II amp, you don't really need bass. He has enough low end that he can carry the whole rhythm section. The next question is from Tom, the Citadel. He says, hi, Jim. If there is no college football season this year, will this be the most detrimental to USC in the Pac-12? No, not really. USC's got a tough schedule this year. They've got to go into Jerry World, play Alabama on the road in a venue that has not been very kind to them against an Alabama team that will have an edge in preparation. I don't expect USC to win that game. And if you're a Trojan fan, you hope USC just doesn't come out of that game getting blown out, because that in itself would take a big hit on the recruiting trail. And USC has other games on the road that could really hurt them on the recruiting trail. So they could actually benefit by not playing a season and just continuing to recruit well and being able to get themselves to a point where maybe they can get a transfer at left tackle for the 2021 season. Maybe they can find a third scholarship quarterback, because that's obviously a big issue, only playing with 2 scholarship quarterbacks this season. There are plenty of arguments that not having a season is actually an advantage to USC. David Law comes back for his second question, and he says, second page, second set of questions. Number 1, have we lost any momentum on the recruiting trail in the past couple weeks, or hit a lull, or is everything good? Number 2, what is your favorite breakfast cereal? We have hit a bit of a recruiting lull, but I think I explained that in the opening of the podcast and last week in the war room. In terms of breakfast cereals, I really don't eat a lot of cereal, but it's funny that you asked that, because yesterday was my cheat day, and for that, I actually had Raisin Bran with a little whipped cream and half and half. That was my cheat day meal. But if I was to go back to when I was a kid and I actually ate cereal, I'd say Cocoa Pebbles or Fruity Pebbles would probably be my favorite. The next question comes from Gunham. Gunham asks, how much control does it appear that Helton has over his staff in the type of players they go after? Are there any kinds of traits, characteristics, or profiles that Helton dictates that recruits must have? Is Helton trying to lock down California or just get anyone anywhere that he thinks will fit his criteria? I don't get the sense that Clay Helton likes to dictate. I think he likes to delegate. He's always given his assistant coaches a lot of freedom when it comes to player personnel choices. And I think that's true on the recruiting trail as well. He has coordinators and assistant coaches that are coaching within a specific scheme, and they want specific profile players to be able to play in that scheme. Clay Helton didn't come to USC as a schematically motivated coach. He didn't come to USC as a coach that ran a specific scheme, so he was looking for a specific type of player to run that scheme. Nor did he coach at USC as an assistant coach or a coordinator with a overreaching philosophy from the head coach. So Pete Carroll had some very specific overreaching philosophies when it came to coaching. Lane Kiffin didn't have that. Steve Sarkisian didn't have that. So from that standpoint, I don't necessarily know that he's dictating he wants a specific type of player, even when it comes to intangibles. Now, of course, you want kids that are going to make grades. You want kids that are going to be low maintenance and not get in trouble off the field. But in general, looking for a certain personality trait, I don't necessarily know that Clay Helton is dictating that to any of his assistant coaches on the recruiting trail. Our final question of the podcast comes from the man in the Mac, who says, Jim, when SC is good on the field, does it make your job more enjoyable, less enjoyable, or is that irrelevant? Same question, but when they are recruiting well, for example, when they're actually trying. The job is always more enjoyable when USC is winning, mainly because of the message boards. I don't have to delete trolls. I don't have to moderate irate fans who are threatening to cancel their subscriptions because they're in protest over the administration's choices of coaching staff. A lot of that vitriol spills over and gets directed at us, which we obviously have no control over who the head coach is going to be or how the team plays from week to week. If USC's winning, the message boards are copacetic, and my job is a lot easier, if not more enjoyable. From a recruiting standpoint, if USC is recruiting at a high level, the job is more enjoyable, mainly because you're watching better players and you're projecting how these dynamic talents fit into the grand scheme of things for USC, and how does that affect the ultimate ceiling that the team has in the coming years. When USC doesn't recruit well, and they're going after three-star players that nobody's heard of, I find that I have to almost be on the defensive and try to play devil's advocate as to why this player might be underrated, why this player is a USC-level player, and why the sky isn't falling. I'm certainly not going to mislead you with false evaluations, but my job is to provide insight. So just piling on and adding to how sucky the suck is isn't worth your time and certainly isn't worth your money. That's going to do it for this week's Recruiting Rant Podcast. I'm your host, Gerard Martinez. You can follow me at GMART Live on Twitter or always reach out to me with follow-up questions on the Peristyle. Thank you to all our subscribers who participated in the podcast this week. And as usual, stay tuned to USCFootball.com for the best in USC athletics and recruiting.